You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Risoul.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Evening.
Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Lionel, where are we?
We are in the Alpine Ski Resort of Risoul. It's like a sort of mini Alpe d'Huez. It's actually a bit nicer than Alpe d'Huez, I think.
Considerably nicer.
It is considerably nicer, yeah. It's your typical chalet-style hotels and apartments, lots of pizzerias, places doing fondue. Shame we won't be up here long enough to sample a fondue or a raclette tonight. But we're just having a post-stage beer and we're going to debrief stage 14 of the Tour de France, won by Rafa Majka of Tinkoff Saxo.
I believe Oleg Tinkoff, the team owner, was quite emotional at the finish. Daniel, did you spot that?
Yeah, he was. He was crying on live French TV. He was quite sheepish about how emotional he'd got. He pulled on his sunglasses at one point. He didn't want people to see him crying. But yeah, I was quite shocked to see that. You know, it's not the kind of reaction you expect from Oleg Tinkoff.
He'd recovered by the time he got back to the team bus, though, because he was asked what he was going to do this evening, because he wrapped up his interviews. He was asked what he was going to do.
Is this suitable for a podcast?
Yeah, well, he said he was going to crack open the Dom Perignon.
Right. Yeah, thank goodness for that. That's all he's going to do. Rafa Majka, I mean, he was a sort of doubtful starter for the Tour. He had a terrific Giro d'Italia, one of the strongest riders there. And then he stepped into the Tinkoff Saxo team quite late in the day. It was certainly reported to replace Roman Kreuziger, who has been sidelined as an investigation has opened up into bicycle passport irregularities. However, Majka dismissed that claim.
So did Bjarne Riis in the pre-tour press conference, although I'm not terribly sure that that's necessarily particularly credible. Perhaps he was just saying that because, you know, you don't want to be the guy that was just called up as a last minute, really, do you? But he had just finished sixth in the Giro, so asking him to come and do the Tour de France as well is a big ask for a rider who's only 24.
Yeah, another last minute call up, and again due to a doping case, and we know this in this particular situation, was Simon Yates, who was in the breakaway again today, the second Saturday in a row that he's been in the break. It was in the Vosges Mountains last week, but the real high mountains today. He's 21 years old. He's the youngest rider in the race now after Danny Van Poppel's withdrawal. And he rode very, very well in that break and was one of the last survivors, really, reeled in with 5.5 kilometres to go to the top. Didn't seem daunted at all by the company or by the climbs. And I spoke to him briefly at the finish, and here is Simon Yates reflecting with a little bit of disappointment, I felt, on his big day out. Simon, how hard was it to get in the breakaway initially?
It's flat out as usual, you know, and it's the hardest bit of the day, really, except for the finish. You know, once you actually get there, you just kind of, you know, having worked really well together and settles down to a manageable pace.
Were you determined to get in that move today, though?
Another day's, you know, the brakes went to line, and another opportunity to win stage.
How was it climbing those sorts of high? We've seen you, you know, excel on smaller climbs, but how was it in those high mountains?
Yeah, it was all right. You know, I wouldn't say, maybe not compared to these, you know, top guys, you know, the proper GC guys, but, you know, I'm no slouch on the climbs, long climbs or short climbs, you know, and, you know, I'm only a small guy, you know, what, 58 kilos, so.
Yeah, I was quite struck. Again, I think we've all been struck at various times by just how Simon Yates is taking this Tour debut in his stride. He was in that break to try and win the stage, not to be in the break. That seemed pretty clear at the finish. He was a little bit disappointed that it didn't work out for him. And so it paid tribute to Majka, who's a few years older, not that much older, he's 25 years old. Somebody pointed out...
24,
apologies. Good. It's becoming a good tour for young riders, isn't it? We want to talk about the overall battle that's shaping up. Is there an overall battle? Nibali is a very convincing yellow jersey, is sort of increasing his lead day by day. He's 4.5 minutes ahead now. It's still worth bearing in mind that over half of that advantage came on the cobble day. So although Daniel's mentioned this, his attacks look very impressive and he always gains a good gap. He's nibbling away and build, you know, claiming 20 seconds here, 30 seconds there. He's not claiming minutes, but the battle behind him, particularly between the two Frenchmen, Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet, is getting really interesting now, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, and I sort of hesitate to say it's getting nasty and the gloves are off, but it certainly feels as though there is some needle between them, certainly on the bike. You know, AG2R's moved today on the descent off the Izoard. That certainly had a very clear target, who was Pino, and they did manage to unhinge him for a while. He lost sort of 200, 300 metres, and it did look at one time as though he might lose contact irremediably, but he got back on, and you know, just going back to Nibali, Rich, there seems to be kind of almost a growing murmur of suspicion, simply because he's won three stages and he's very, very consistent. But you know, it's worth bearing in mind that today Jean-Christophe Perrault, who's 37 years old, never really figured in the fight for the podium in any major tour. Stuck with him for the majority of that final. Well, he stuck with him right into the finishing straight.
Yeah, let's look. I mean, let's look at this question just briefly. We don't want to go on about this too much. But a couple of comments on Twitter to me about Nibali's performance looking too good to be true. I don't agree with that at all. I mean, coming into this tour, Nibali's not been in great form this year. But still, if you'd been told that he would be running a tour without Contador, without Froome, without Quintana, you know, the other sort of A-list Grand Tour contenders, and he wasn't taking 15, 20 seconds out of Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet and the rest, that would have been a surprise.
Yeah, that would be more surprising.
That would be more surprising if he was finishing with those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a superior athlete. He clearly is. He's, you know, that 2 or 3% better than everyone else in the field, and he's shown that every day, and I expect, if anything, his margin of superiority to grow, because I do feel that some of the others are on the limit, and they're really, you know, it's fantastic to see. But you know, we saw Pino today's really struggling at the end to hold on. I was speaking earlier to Brent Copeland, the Lamprey manager, this morning, and he said that, you know, they've looked at the power files from their own riders from yesterday, and purely on the basis of those files, they can deduce that guys like Bardet and Pino have really, really been on the limit and really been over the limit and in the red, and that they will probably suffer later in the race because of that.
Now, AG2R, Ajay Desir, tell us a little bit about this team, Daniel, because we were just reflecting today as we watched them really take the race by the scruff of the neck on the descent of the Izoard, but even also on the lower slopes of the climb up to Risoul. This is a team that a couple of years ago was a laughing stock. They've tried over the years with overseas leaders. You know, I remember they had Francisco Mancebo briefly before he was caught up in Operation Puerto. Then Nicholas Roach for a few years was their sort of talisman. And they were, you're shaking your head a bit, Daniel, it's maybe an unfair description to call them a laughing stock, but the strength they have now is very impressive. They've got two guys up there overall. Jean-Christophe Perrault, as you say, went with Nibali when he attacked. But what do you put this resurgence down to? And are they a united team? Because it seems that Perrault, seemed today and yesterday, that Perrault and Bardet aren't necessarily working together. It's almost as if they're trying to get two guys up there in the top six rather than one guy on the podium.
I think that they are working fairly well together. I mean, Pierre Rolland, the Europe car rider, tried to stir it up a bit at the finish, and it was put to him that he wasn't collaborating with Jean-Christophe Perrault and that they didn't particularly get on. And he said, well, the big problem, the big war is inside the AG2R team. I don't think that's necessarily true. Yesterday, Bardet's tactics were dictated really by Perrault not wanting to drop Perrault. You know, there were times yesterday when Bardet could have gone up the road and followed Pino. He didn't do it. But it is a team that has a history of at least trying to go well in the mountains. It's more of a climbers team. They're based in the Alps in Chambéry. And, you know, they have had good tours. There was a tour, I forget exactly which one it was, it might have been 2008, with Goubert went well, and Perrault as well has gone well in previous tours, and they've had multiple guys in the top 10 before.
Gadre was a good rider for them for a few.
Gadre, exactly. And, you know, they've got some good climbers who aren't at this race. A real revelation this year has been Alexis Villamoz, who's another former mountain biker, much like Perrault. And and you know, all credit to them for taking the race on. I mean, Nibali is really in an armchair at the moment, because he's got all of these other teams which are absolutely desperate to pursue their agenda, whatever it may be. In AG2R's case, it is, you know, reinforcing their positions high up in the general classification. And Nibali's the fact that, you know, Nibali is a bit short of manpower, is really not being exposed, because there is always someone willing to take it on.
It's a bit like last year with Froome and Team Sky, isn't it? That what we have is one rider who's clearly superior to everybody else, and it's like Nibali doesn't really need his team. But I think the Astana team has not been as strong as we expected them to be.
No, I think they've been inconsistent. You know, Scarponi's had good days, bad days. Fuglsang yesterday had his crash, but we learned today that it was a bidon that had caused the crash. And yeah, they haven't had many days where the whole unit has come together and they've all ridden well. But they're getting away with it at the moment. And you know, when you've got a leader who is as superior as Nibali is, the team is important in the first 100 kilometres of stages, and less so in the last sort of 50, 60, 70 kilometres.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
Let's turn our attention to the winner of today's stage, Rafał Majka, the Polish rider, who is 24 and third pro season and seventh Grand Tour. So he's clocking up quite a lot of experience already. He's second on the first day in the Alps, first today. There was a sort of mini scandal before the tour about whether he really wanted to ride the tour. I remember when he was selected, he complained that his team didn't seem to care about the health of the athletes. So that's kind of been brushed under the carpet now, and he certainly dismissed that in his press conference today. But clearly a very good rider. It's worth pointing out that the break that he was in was away all day. The gap at the bottom of the climb up to Rizul was not great at all. It's about a minute. And you would have bet, I think, on it being swallowed up. Most of the riders, well, all the riders apart from him, were swallowed up. So it was a well-timed attack, and he rode extremely well to hold off Nibali and co.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did pretty much the same thing on the first day in the Alps. He was away for a long time, riding up the last climb to Chamrous with Leopold Koenig. Koenig made that comment about... he expressed a bit of disappointment that Majka hadn't perhaps committed quite as much to staying away. But one of the things that impressed me yesterday on the stage to Chamrous was that when Nibali came past, the pair of them, Koenig and Majka, limited the gap to sort of 10, 11 seconds. And we're not really used to seeing that. I mean, I know this goes back to Nibali's style, which, as you said, Richard, he attacks and then he kind of sits and he doesn't pull out a gap in a way that we've seen the likes of Chris Froome do last year. So, you know, it's really difficult to kind of judge exactly how good Majka and Koenig's ride was at Chamrous. But today, you know, he went out there again, Rafał Majka, and put everything into that escape. And I spoke at the finish to Michael Rogers, who said that it was basically the plan to get into that early move. And in fact, Michael Rogers was supposed to try and get into that move as well, but he missed it by a matter of metres. But because Majka had made it, it all turned out okay. And then I spoke also to Bjarne Riis, the Tinkoff Saxo director sportif, to see how they responded to Majka finishing second on the first stage of the Alps and whether that encouraged him to try again today.
Obviously, Rafa in the breakaway with Nicholas Roach. It was a very fast start. Unfortunately, I just missed the break for a metre or so and couldn't be there, but in the end, it didn't matter. We're obviously really ecstatic. It was a really gutsy ride out there by Majka, and you know, to hold off the bunch coming from behind with Nibali and all the big contenders of the GC. I think he's done a really gutsy ride and really shown his talent and shown he's got a big future, and shows we have a strong team, and we're all smiles, absolutely. Certainly, it's not easy just to come in with the tour. You know, we only had plan A. And then turn around on a short time frame isn't easy. It took us a couple of days, but we kept believing. Luckily, we have a genius people in the team, you know, that didn't pressure us. They empowered us. You know, they could have just changed attitude straight away. They said, guys, listen, we know it's difficult for you and it's difficult for everyone. like I said, they gave us time, they empowered us, and they put their trust in us, and Rafa repaid them today. We knew we had a strong team, and obviously it takes a little bit of time to refind ourselves and refind our character without Alberto, but once again today we did it. And Olic, Diana, they certainly know just as much as anyone how hard it was to lose Alberto. They could have pressured us, but they didn't. They left us, you know, 3 or 4 days to recollect ourselves. Yeah, it was hard. It was, like I said, we came here with plan A. There was no plan B. So overnight, you know, we found ourselves a little bit in dire straits for a couple of days. As I said, we were able to recollect ourselves and set some realistic goals. We knew a stage win was realistic, and it's certainly, I think, a nice gift to the team and to our fans, and certainly an emotional one. Certainly we've been in contact with him on the phone and with messages, and he's giving us updates on his knee. Full of encouragement. He's I'm sure he would have had a bit of a pain, you know, within, you know, watching the team today riding so well, but I think that's a positive pain. You know, we still think about it and dream about every day what Alberto could have done. But the Tour de France is a series of tests, and you have to pass every day. And unfortunately, Alberto couldn't pass one of the tests due to a crash, and that's life.
I think he's a happy little bastard right now. You know? No, it's fantastic. I mean, that was a big number today. Really great victory, because he's been sitting out there the whole day. Pulling in the wind and all everything, you know, and we knew that yesterday, today he was probably our best card.
Yeah.
And condition is coming, and it's just great. A couple of years he's been up there, top 5, 6, 7 or whatever it is in the Giro. It's not bad, you know. He's still very young, needs some kind of experience, but it's coming. And a race like this, I think he learned a lot.
Yeah.
About everything, you know, been riding with Alberto, the other guys, and go here and win, you learn a hell lot, you know, and see ups and downs, and that's what you need as a mature pro, and he's just still a kid, you know? If your GC rider's out, then you need to aim for new things, and I think we're good at that, to be honest. The way that kept the morale and the motivation high, the spirit, it's just great.
Did you talk to him last night after he was so close yesterday?
Yeah, but he was motivated. He was a little pissed he couldn't win, of course, but he was motivated and believed that he has a chance today, and he wanted to go in a break today. And I said, well, said to the team, make him be there, you know, make sure he's there and take him up and leave him in a breakaway. And then, I mean, at least that's what we can do, and then we see.
Did the fact that Nibali only took 10 seconds from him when he came past yesterday, does that give a rider confidence that he's up there at that level?
Absolutely. I mean, like, he was pulling the whole day in a breakaway, and being out there in the breakaway the whole day and then not losing anything to Nibali on the last climb, I think that proves that he's not too bad.
And lastly for me, tactically, what was the moment today? Who kind of made the call? Was there any talk between the team car and Micah, or did he pick his own moment?
No, we were talking, giving information and said kind of what to do, and stay calm, eat and drink, and, you know, go when you have to go.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Daniel, you have anything to add on Micah?
Micah, well, certainly for the first year or so of his career, he was associated with quite a nice story about how he'd come to get a professional contract with what was Saxo Bank at the time. Bjarne Riis has always invited promising under 23 riders to training camps and sort of trialed them in a way that other teams do at the end of seasons, and they're what's called stagiaires, which is basically work experience boys, which you're allowed to, I think from the 1st of August under UCI rules, you're allowed to have 3 stagiaires on every team. But Riis also has this history of inviting guys to training camps, and at the first one that Micah attended for Saxo Bank, he supposedly stuck with Contador, or dropped him on a quite a difficult climb in a training camp, and was hence offered a contract by Riis. But I can remember speaking to quite a few guys about him in his first season as a pro, and you know, with this story in mind about how phenomenal he'd supposedly been in training. And people didn't really rate him. Even guys in the team, they were quite sceptical about how good he was going to turn out to be. So, it's interesting to see how he's really starting to thrive. Rode an excellent Giro and is incredibly strong here at the Tour de France.
I love how I say, Daniel, you got anything out of Mike? And you say, no, but, and then come out with quite an interesting little anecdote there. That was good. Yeah, Mike, he was a revelation at the Giro, I think, and clearly a great talent. He's well done overall, partly because plan A was obviously Alberto Contador, and they all waited for him.
I was actually going to say red card for anyone who mentions plan A or B or plan G. I've had it up to here with plans.
Okay, but hang on, plan B. For we saw some plan Bs being executed today by obviously Tinkoff Saxo and Sky, who put both Geraint Thomas and Mikael Nieve in the break. Quite surprising, Nieve. Geraint Thomas did a lot of work for him. And quite surprised to see him fall away as much as he did on the climb, because he is a very good climber. I think he'll be better in the Pyrenees. He's a Basque climber, knows those climbs well, and he rode extremely well at the Tour de France last year. I remember also he rode over your foot, Daniel, at Axe Trois Domaines, and then turned around and apologised, which is absolutely unheard of. So he's obviously a very nice bloke.
Should say that wasn't during the race, that was in the post race scrum, wasn't it?
It was just after the finish line. Daniel was hovering with his tape recorder. We should just say one thing briefly on Geraint Thomas. We were accused of giving Geraint Thomas a hard time. Daniel gave Geraint Thomas a hard time last night. Geraint Thomas is a tremendous bike rider, incredibly versatile, incredibly hard working. Very visible always in races, maybe partly because of the white-rimmed glasses that he wears at this tour. There's no question that he's a superb athlete, an incredible bike rider. But the shift from that to he's a potential sort of team leader or Grand Tour contender is a massive leap, isn't it? And we're just not sure that is a justifiable sort of position to take.
I think this issue of visibility in races is a really interesting one, because Dave Burswood was saying on the rest day that riders that you notice in races on TV, because let's face it, we assess pretty much everything we see in races from three things: what people tell us, what we see with our own eyes, which is 95% of which is on television, and the result sheet, which kind of confirms or contradicts your kind of predetermined impression of a particular rider. And you're exactly right about Thomas. You see him much more in a race than you see Richie Porte hides away a lot more, you know, he would, except when he would be on the front working for Chris Froome. And I think it's really sort of interesting the way the tour has panned out this year from a Sky perspective, and people saying in hindsight, you know, what they should have done, whether Bradley Wiggins should have been here or whether Geraint Thomas should have been the plan B. Red card for me for saying plan B. I think it's a weird, slightly
red card line, off you go.
Yeah,
go,
I think it's a slightly weird obsession to have it, this kind of after the fact tactical re-evaluation of how the race has panned out. The bottom line is Chris Froome crashed out, and now they have to deal with a team that was put together solely to support Chris Froome. Yeah, and what can they salvage from that?
The fact that Chris Froome has crashed out doesn't make the decision not to bring Bradley Wiggins the wrong one. You know, if it was the right one coming into race, then it's kind of pointless. Can you argue that?
No, I mean, when I said that he was a million miles away from being a Grand Tour leader, that what I meant was that he could perhaps have the potential to be that, but there are so many stages that he has to go through, so many sort of phases of in his development before he becomes that guy. And this is one of the problems with the current setup at Team Sky. There aren't a lot of guys getting experience of leading the team in important stage races, and yesterday was a good example. And I don't know what happened yesterday, whether Geraint Thomas was told to go back and wait for Richie Porte or whether that was his decision. We know he's an incredibly selfless rider, and it wouldn't surprise me if he'd taken that decision of his own initiative. But it would almost be more useful now, with 10 days of the tour remaining, to say to Geraint Thomas, look, let's just see what you can do for the next 10 days. Let's see if you're on a bad day, you can dig in and limit your losses to 2 minutes. And let's just try to assess, how feasible riding a Grand Tour would be with you as the leader.
Yeah, I think, Daniel, you kind of picked me up. Your very strident comment about Geraint Thomas's potential. You came off the back of my comment about it being a shame that we can't see in this Tour de France where Geraint Thomas can go with the talent he has. And you said, well, I think we kind of are. And I was thinking about that and thinking, yeah, on the one hand, yes, absolutely. But on the other hand, you can't reboot the Tour de France 12 days in and pretend that all of the work and all of that other responsibility that he's been through in the first 3-4 days, stress and work that he did for Chris Froome, and then after that the work he's done for Richie Porte, you can't make that unhappen. You can't say, well, now Geraint, you can be a GC leader for the remaining 10 days of the race, because he's got that first almost a fortnight in his legs. It doesn't quite work like that. So if you say, okay, dig in, limit your losses, and he finishes 35th on the stage, that doesn't tell us outside observers very much. It might tell Sky's performance analysts something, but it doesn't necessarily add to the case for, you know, Geraint Thomas being given a leadership role in a Grand Tour next time out.
I don't know, Lionel, I sort of disagree with that. I think that leading a team in a Grand Tour is a mental discipline more than anything else, and I think we've seen that with Richie Porte. I don't know physiologically, I'm not sure what's happened with Richie Porte the last 2 days, but I'm sure there's a mental component. I'm sure part of it is him at a certain point in both yesterday and today saying that, like, realizing that he can't contend anymore, and his motivation probably does drop. I think it's important for Geraint Thomas, and this is where I think there is no doubt that he at his highest level he can be in the top 10 climbers, he can be in the top 10 riders on the flat. There is no doubt where the kind of apex of his abilities lies. It is in the very, very top level. What we don't know is whether he can sustain that over 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, day after day after day, even when he's not feeling well, even when there's a risk of crashes, etc. That is the big question mark with Geraint Thomas. And I think it'd be useful at this stage in his development to say, right, Geraint, forget about the team for 10 days. Let's see what you can do over there. And if he finishes 30th, you know, they're not... What we think as observers, as fans, shouldn't really matter. Sky should be building towards the future, and you know, he's a major asset, he's a major investment for them. They pay him a lot of money. They need to assess what they're going to do with him over the next 3 years.
The other point about visibility is that we see a lot of riders like Geraint Thomas and others as well, because their job is at the front of the race. There's an awful lot of riders whose job is at the back of the race. And you know, it was noticeable when Zandio was forced out, Team Sky, the sort of veteran Spanish rider. He was sorely missed, and Dave Brailsford talked about just the amount of work he does at the back of the race, collecting bottles, that kind of thing, which, you know, is not to be underestimated in terms of the efforts required to do that job. So, you know, this is what makes it so hard to assess each rider's contribution to the team. And it links a bit to your challenge that you set, Lionel, which is still ongoing, to name your sort of ideal team for the Tour de France. You'll find details of that on thecyclingpodcast.com. Please send in your nominations for that team. We'll get Dave Brailsford and other DSs to look over it. You can also find us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast, and we're on Facebook as well. Find us there.
Yeah, just on that point about assembling a team for a Grand Tour, and Sky, using Sky as an example, when they lost Zandio, they lose a rider who's going to do an awful lot of that work, dropping back to the team car, getting bottles. It basically places greater strain on each other member in that team. So, for example, Danny Pate, who would now be perhaps the rider looking after, say, the first 60, 70 kilometres to go back for bottles, or you know, look after his teammate, he might now have to do 80 or 90 kilometres of that work. He might have to do an extra run to go and collect bottles, and that toll is added to his workload, and then that adds to the next rider, and it basically reduces the amount of work that the top riders who were supposed to be supporting Richie Porte were able to do.
Speaking of which, whose round is it?
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at @cycling_podcast.
We're in the mountains. Most of us enjoy this part of the race when we're in the Alps. We're very close to the Italian border, but we're not really in our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio's natural habitat, because, as we know, he prefers the beach. However, he has graced us with his presence.
Good evening to everyone, to our listeners. I have to say, dear friends, Daniel knows me already better than my family. But maybe You are my family now, I was thinking. I mean, my new family is our marvelous podcast, yeah.
Well, Ciro, there is a competition ongoing for our listeners to win a phone call from you, which will be next week. Please tweet hashtag ChiroCall and explain why Ciro should speak to you. Had a couple of entries already. Interest is growing in that competition, and I expect it to really take off over the weekend. But Ciro, we're very close to Italy today, and a lot of Italian support on the climb there, a lot of Italian flags.
Yeah, I noticed for the first time in this Tour de France a lot of Italian flags, I mean, already on the Isoard and then also on the last climb here in Risul. Certainly, it's not really surprising for two reasons, because we are near to Italy and because we have an Italian that really can win the Tour after 16 years. So yes, a lot of Italy here. We are near to Italy, but we are not near to the sea. So
Is Italy getting excited about Vincenzo Nibali?
Yeah. Italy, now the interest for the Tour de France and for Vincenzo now is really increasing, and I think that in Finland last week he will be able to keep the jersey again till Paris. Yes, I mean, it will be great, but I don't think that in Italy it will be a kind of Nibali mania, I want to say, after the Tour de France, as was for Pantani 16 years ago. My impression, I mean, they are different, also their charisma is different. So in my opinion, not. I can be wrong, but this is my opinion.
Now, Ciro, changing subject slightly, Vincenzo in the press conference was asked about scandalous reports a few years ago, unfounded reports, he certainly said, about sightings of Nibali with Michele Ferrari. Now, there were more scandalous allegations last night about sightings of you, not with Michele Ferrari, but in a Buffalo Grill. Lionel, you're probably the best man to explain to listeners what a Buffalo Grill is.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah. Well, as listeners may well know now, I'm writing a blog on my own website, lionelburney.com/gourmet, in which I basically share the meals that I've eaten as we've gone around the Tour de France. We had three very good meals in a row. Not so good last night. I'll update that probably tomorrow. Buffalo Grill, for the listeners, I don't want to spoil Ciro's description, but if you've ever been to a Harvester, you'll have a pretty good idea of what it's like. Ciro, what did you make of the food? Did they do pasta?
No, not at all. Hamburger, a famous baked burger was the name. But I'm happy that we talk about the Buffalo Grill of yesterday night. We talk about with our listeners, because so that our listeners can understand which is my destiny of in this Tour de France. I mean, not dinner till 10:30 p.m. and then have dinner in the first place that you find. And so this happened to me yesterday, so it's a cruel destiny for me, yes, but it's like that. I can't do nothing. Fortunately, if I can finish, dear Lionel, that, as I told you again already, that this cycling podcast exists. Otherwise, my days, I can assure you, are really, really sad.
Okay, Ciro, you better go on with writing the whole of Gazzetta dello Sport for tomorrow.
Actually, I don't know yet. I don't know yet, because we are already talking about with my chief. Maybe we'll do also a special story about Maika, the man that didn't come apparently to the Tour de France and after the Giro, and now he won the stage. And maybe something new about the future of Giuseppe Martinelli, the sport director of Astana. He will be in Team Astana for next year or not? He has the contract, but he's not sure. But I can't anticipate other things for the moment.
Watch out for Gazzetta for that.
We've been scheming, haven't we, Ciro? We've been deliberating about this, Martinelli, tonight. There could be a bit of a scoop tomorrow in the Gazzetta.
No, I mean, not a scoop, because I'm not sure about the future of Beppe Martinelli. But there are growing up some hypotheses, so we can see. Maybe we could talk also about this in another episode of our marvelous cycling podcast.
Okay, Ciro, thank you very much. Good luck.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph cycling podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Always great to hear from our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio. And as I mentioned in that last section, you can win a phone call from Ciro if you tweet hashtag ChiroCall. I should also say that if you are following the Tour every day, the best place to follow the live action is on the Telegraph live blog, usually done by John McCleary, who works on the Telegraph sports desk, really knows his cycling, and it's a very entertaining and informative live blog there at the Telegraph website. So you're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. And I think you guys were floating around at the finish today up in Risoul. And did you speak to anybody, Daniel?
I did. I think we've mentioned Roman Bardet's sister before, haven't we? She, Lisa, her name is, and she works in the press room, distributing results, generally looking after everyone. She's one of about four or five. They're all fairly young, aren't they, staff that look after us in the press room. And we learned earlier in the tour, not only that was she Roman Bardet's sister, but she worked for a month in Look Mum No Hands, the cycling cafe in London. Anyway, within a minute or two of the finish, she was still very excited at the time about her brother's performance.
I'm interested about that, Daniel. Can I just jump in there briefly?
Right,
because you see her in the press room, she hasn't looked to me that interested in the race, but is that a false impression?
No, I think the last 2 days she's been watching the last 10 or 15 kilometres, and today she was certainly very excited. And yep, I spoke to her a minute or two after the finish, and she confirmed to me that, yep, she'd been quite nervous, very excited, and was a very proud sister.
Well, I'm very proud. I think there's no word to describe it, because it's amazing. I would never have thought you would have gone so far and so high.
Has cycling always been in your family?
Yeah. My father is passionate, so my brother rode riding bikes since he's like 5 or something like that.
And you?
Yeah, me too. It's like a family thing, cycling.
Your job means that you can't really pay too much attention to what's going on in the race, but I've seen you a few times kind of coming into the press room and checking on the TV screen,
the stage,
especially
yeah.
The last 2 days now in the mountains.
Yeah, because it's really interesting to see how it all goes in the mountain and my brother. But I think I'm really in a good place to see the TV, to watch the TV here, so yeah. I'm really good.
How nervous are you when you're watching the stage, like today? I mean, are you very nervous watching it?
Yeah, I'm really nervous, but I'm more nervous before the stage than yeah. when it happens, because my brother seemed to be quite calm,
yeah.
So yeah, it's reassuring.
Okay, and you speak to him here on the race, or?
Yeah, every day,
okay.
I just call him. But we do not speak that much, and right. how it goes, more about like what we do
yeah.
outside cycling.
What about your parents? Where are they watching the tour?
They're at home now because
yeah.
they're working. My mother was on stage today in
okay.
Côte d'Azur.
Right.
And my father comes
right.
next week. So.
Right, okay. And to know whether he can maintain this and whether he can finish on the podium in Paris, what do you think? What's your gut instinct?
For me, I'm proud that he does his best, so whatever I do, it's always good.
Okay, and there's an awful lot of heat every day. Has for the last week, there's been
yeah,
something on Roman every day, usually on the cover. How do you think he's going to react to that pressure? How is he reacting to it? Does he pay any attention to all of that?
Well, he tries to be aloof.
Yeah.
But he likes to read L'Équipe to see how the race is seen from the journalist's point of view.
Yeah.
But yeah, he tries to distance himself from all this pressure.
Right.
Because it takes a lot of energy from
yeah.
him. So
yeah.
he'll see after how it was all seen. He's quite sure of himself.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
And Lionel, you were floating around at the finish as well, while Daniel was back at the press centre interviewing Lisa and Bardet. You were at the finish around the buses, and who did you speak to?
Well, I was going to try and speak to TJ Van Garderen, but I left that to our good friend Andy Hood from Velo News. He'll report back in the Velo News edition of the cycling podcast on the rest day, which is Monday. But instead, I spoke to Peter Velitz, who is Van Garderen's BMC Racing teammate, just about how they were keeping Van Garderen in position. There was a little moment where he looked like he might be losing contact a bit with that front group, and then he really was setting a strong pace on the final climb.
Valitz, of course, was in my, what do we call it, I'm the armchair director. Oh, the Barnett, the best Barnett nine, he was very much, he was one of the first names.
I'd like to, I had a good look at Brian Cockard's hair the other day. I'd like to nominate him as well. Somebody we talked about quite a lot at the start of the tour, but he's gone off the radar a bit, but he's got good hair.
My team is Gadray, Horner, seven others. Press officer will be Brian Nygaard. all baldies, of course. Anyway, yeah, so Peter Valitz, part of quite a strong BMC racing team. They have looked after Van Garderen well, and I think there's a real sense of confidence that Van Garderen is coming good just at the right time in the race. He's not going to win it, of course, but he's loitering in fifth place, and of all of those riders in the top positions, he's probably the best time trialist. So BMC Racing are going to try and keep him on the shoulders of the likes of Romain Bardet and Thibaut Pinot, and hope that on the final time trial from Bergerac to Périgueux, that Van Garderen can move up onto the podium, perhaps even take second place from Valverde. The team must be getting a lot of confidence from the way TJ Van Garderen is riding. He seems to be coming better as we go through the more mountainous stages, and perhaps the good weather, is that a factor also?
I don't think TJ has such a big problem with the weather. He can ride also in the rain, in the colder, in a super hot weather. So it's not really a big deal for him, but it's perfect for the team. That is what we're aiming for, that he will get higher and higher in the GC. It gives for everybody much more confidence when we see him always there, always with the best guy. So that makes our job even more enjoyable, even more better. We can do it even more better.
So what was your role specifically in the team today?
I mean, like all the other guys, try to stay with TJ as long as possible, but then bring him in a good position under the last climb. But even we saw the climb before in Isola, the Ash Dar went pretty hard there, and they split the bunch in a downhill. So there was exactly the point of work for us to bring TJ back to that split where was Nibali and Pinot. So we did it, but it was perfect, and then TJ stayed with the best again. So yeah, it's really good. We just hope that some of the guys will crack in front of him, and what happened, like the same like what happened with Richie yesterday. So we see how it goes, and if not, when TJ is really close to the other guys, he's really good in time trial, and the time trial will be really, really good for him.
Do you think the podium is still within reach then, with that time trial to come?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. If nothing bad happens, if there is no big issue on the road till the time trial, then TJ is one of the strongest in the time trial. So I think it's really reachable, and that will be just awesome. I mean, so far we were pretty good in positioning the whole team, or at least TJ was always in a good position. All other guys from the team, there was always someone with him. That was the same what happened today. We were three guys with him there, so it was just perfect. And he never got to the situation like he was alone in the middle of the stage and didn't have anyone to help. So it doesn't matter if you are on a flat or in a climb, so the team is still strong enough to be with him in this crucial moment. And of course, like when it goes to the uphill finish, that is only up to him. But yeah, that's what I was saying. Like all his results also give us confidence, and we're trying even harder to stay with him, to help him as much as possible. And then when we get the results like this, that he stays with the best, and it's perfect.
And lastly, what are your impressions of Nibali, and what do other riders in the bunch think of him? He does seem to be clearly the best in this race.
Definitely. So far he's unbeatable. He won the most crucial uphill finishes also, so it's really... if nothing special happens, if he doesn't have any bad luck, then I think he's the favorite. He's the top guy to be in a Paris. I don't think he will lose so much in a time trial, and in uphill finishes he seems he's pretty strong, and he's not that kind of guy who gets really bad day and lost 10 minutes in one day. So even when he has bad day, then he loses maybe a few seconds, maximum minutes, but that's it, not a minute.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboom, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
We were slightly distracted there by a man in a large furry pig costume, obviously been supporting
smoking
on the mountain.
Smoking a cigarette.
You sure it's a cigarette?
Not
sure
something you see every day. He's just put his head down again. And, yep, he's given us the V sign. So, yeah, no, that's great. Great to see a man in a pig outfit. Any other business? Tomorrow we're back with a flat stage to Nîmes and then a rest day. Sprinter stage again. Marcel Kittel?
Yeah, practically a rest day for us really, isn't it? You know, get to the press room nice and early. Hopefully there'll be a buffet. There wasn't one today. That always perturbs me.
Great. Yeah, tomorrow's stay to Nîmes. It's a bit of a shame it's not going slightly closer to the coast. Usually in that part of the world, the race goes into the region known as the Camargue, the sort of, what are they, salt flats, marshlands.
Famous for the flamingos.
White horses and crosswinds. And
little pigs.
And echelons in the Tour de France. We've seen numerous stages over the last few years through the Camargue that have yielded fantastic action, crosswinds, splits. But I don't think we're going quite close enough tomorrow.
No, it's quite a long stage and they are avoiding all the difficulties as well, aren't they? It's a little bit lumpy at the start, but then it's all the way downhill to Nîmes. I'll be interested to see where the finish is, whether it's near the amphitheatre, because that's quite spectacular.
Yeah, well, I saw my first bullfight there, Lionel.
Oh, controversial, Daniel, alienating some of our
first
listeners.
First and last, I must say.
Okay, that's fine, get away with that. We've got a long drive tonight, Lionel, to our hotel. So
where are you chaps?
A long way away, two hour drive, beyond Gap. Beyond Gap, Daniel. So we've got a long way to go, so we better pack up and go. So Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you both. It's been a delight.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.